The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn 2% cash rewards on what you want, like season tickets to watch your favorite team, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like paying for parking. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pot of thunder and rock and roll, and let's go. It's the Duff McKagan joke of the week.
This Jericho, Duff McKagan calling you, man. I don't know if I told you, I took a real-life stuffed dog, dead, you know, to an antiques roadshow. And the chap there asked me, any idea of what it would fetch if we're in good condition? I said, a stick, perhaps? Thank you very much. Goodbye.
All right. Thanks to Duff. What you don't hear sometimes is the ones that he calls in and he screws up and has to call in again. It's always a riot. But thanks to Duff for bringing the laughs every single week. And thanks to all of you who've been laughing along with the Winnipeggers every Thursday night. New episode dropped last night at 9 p.m. Eastern on my Facebook page and the YouTube channel. Dave Spivak, Ribo, and I are talking about our first yobs/jobs since we don't pronounce J's. On the Winnipeggers. Let's say there's a lot of delivery gigs, free food, video games, sheep manure. You hear a story about Dwayne Johnson, but not that Dwayne Johnson. Winnipeg's Dwayne Johnson. He looks like a ginger. They say he looks like a ginger puppet or something along those lines. The time Dave's dad forced him to get a job. It was actually a really great taping last night and a lot of fun. So come join us with the Winnipeggers. New episodes every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern. All right, today we're talking about 30 wrestling shows in 30 days with hotshot Danny Dugan and AJ Sanchez. Danny runs the Canadian Wrestling Elite promotion based out of Winnipeg. He's been building steam and adding dates every year for the last few years. And the story of the company, the gimmick, if you will, is they do a crazy one-of-a-kind tour that's literally 30 shows in 30 days. They travel across Canada, and until the pandemic, they hadn't missed a show ever, although they've had plenty of near misses over the history of the tour. Over the course of this year, they had to cancel a lot of the scheduled shows because of the lockdown, because of COVID. But good news is the following shows will happen as planned in the month of October and November. So if you're jonesing for some live wrestling and you live in kind of Western Canada area, get your tickets now at cwetickets.com and go check out one of these dates. 10/17, Gladstone, Manitoba. October 22nd, Calgary. 23rd, Red Deer. 24th, St. Albert, just outside of Edmonton. 26th is Grand Prairie, Alberta. 31st, Halloween in Medicine Hat. The 5th is in Morden. They take it home in my hometown of Winnipeg on November 6th. Again, you can get tickets at cwetickets.com. The shows are great. Lots of great talent. You're going to hear all about their mindset, their business plan from Danny and AJ. They also talk about how CWE got started, some of the special guests they've had on the road, Jake the Snake Roberts, Brutus the Barber Beefcake, well, that didn't work out so well for them. They've got stories about traveling through the snowy, freezing, cold Canadian winters, vehicle breakdowns, special guests bailing out, all kinds of crazy obstacles that have happened on tour. But amazingly, like I said, they never missed a show. Very unique business model for wrestling, and Danny explains how he's not only been able to make it work, but also how he's managed to grow his company and add more cities to the tour pre-corona and hopefully post-corona as well. So here we go. 30 wrestling shows in 30 days starts now on Talk is Jericho. All right, so a friend of mine, Jimmy Jacobs, texted me a few months ago and let me know that he was on a tour of Canada, a very interesting tour, and I wanted to talk about that with the people behind it, and that's hotshot Danny Dugan here, and AJ Sanchez is also on board. You guys are both Winnipeg guys?
Yes, sir. Born and raised.
Yes, sir.
So it's really cool to be, because so, you guys basically did a tour of 30 shows basically in 30 days.
Yeah, we just finished up a tour of 31, and that's pretty common. We do a couple a year ranging from 30 to 38 across the country.
That's amazing. And the reason why it really appealed to me is I would have loved something like that when I was first starting out, because that's not easy to do, especially with all the traveling and all that sort of stuff. What gave you the idea to try something like that?
Well, when we first started running the tours, we were just running monthly events out of the city of Winnipeg. And as you know, being from Canada, there's not a lot of wrestling opportunity for wrestlers in Central or Western Canada to not only get on the road and travel and make a living here in the country, but to network and get out and make opportunities for themselves elsewhere. So we thought if we provided enough work for the guys here to stay polished and have enough work to be appealing for guys to come in from other territories, hopefully our guys would be connected with some talent that can get them on out of here and their work would improve. So that's kind of what the vision was when we first started putting it all together.
So you guys both train in Winnipeg?
Yes, sir. I originally trained under a fellow by the name of Gene Swan, and then a little bit later with hotshot Johnny Devine.
How about you, AJ?
Yeah, well, I would use the term training in a very loose manner originally, but I had trained with a local guy named Rob Stardom, and then got to work with Johnny Devine as well a little while later in my career.
Okay, because it's funny, because you mentioned Gene Swan. He was in Winnipeg working when I was working, one of the Candelo guys, for sure. It's it's funny, because I know, too, and you guys both worked with Kenny Omega as well?
Yeah, Kenny started probably about a year or two before I did, and I got an opportunity to do a lot of traveling with him early in his career, and we did some tag team stuff here in CWE the first couple of years of our operations as well, so he's somebody we know very well.
What was the young Kenny Omega like?
Probably the same as the old Kenny Omega. Not much has changed in that sense, and he's kind of always been a guy who's kind of gone to the own, you know, the beat of his own drum, and has been very adamant that he wants to do things his way and his style of professional wrestling, and he's kind of stayed true to that through his entire career, and he's gotten where he is today.
Yeah, I mean, that's you definitely hit the nail on the head for that. And once again, too, it's cool that the Winnipeg wrestling scene, because I say just the fact that you guys are there and doing these tours, and I really want to get into that. But I think if you take – people always talk about Canadians being great wrestlers, and they always go back to Calgary. And I'm like, absolutely not. Winnipeg is the home of the best wrestlers. If you took the four best wrestlers from Winnipeg, they would easily beat the four best wrestlers from Calgary. Even if you're talking like Jericho, Omega, Piper, and Don Callis, take those four.
100%. That's been a big common misperception of Winnipeg for a long, long time. Just with Stampede kind of being the more prominent Canadian promotion to fans outside Canadian wrestling bubble, they always get that recognition and get that fame. But you nailed it. Even to this day, over the last 10, 15, 20 years, I would put the top Winnipeg wrestlers on an independent level against any level of talent in any other part of the country, and we'd come up on top.
Who's there now? Because if you're talking about, you know, the Canadian guys, I always go back to, you know, like I mentioned with Tony Candelo, and it was Don Callis' time, and then there was Chi-Chi Cruz and Gene Swan, and, you know, you mentioned Red Bastien Jr. and El Flippo and Tulip and Captain Jones and Stan Saxon and all those type of guys. Who's on the scene now that's working quite regularly?
Well, in some capacity, all those guys you mentioned are still kicking around, you know, whether it be just stopping by and giving advice to the talent or still performing themselves. But from that era, guys that are still performing, Wildman Furpo is going on year 44 as a Winnipeg professional wrestler, and he has no signs of slowing down. He's definitely moving very slow, so I guess he's slow in that capacity, but he still has many years ahead of him, I think he believes. Easy Rider just came back from some back surgery, and he's back in the ring for the first time in a few years, and I believe that's someone you probably encountered in the WFWA days.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Who else?
Dr. Marty Goldstein. All kinds of guys are still kicking around from that era. We even had Caveman Broda in a battle royal at 60-something years old a couple weeks ago.
I was just going to ask that. He's the very first tour I ever did was I was doing the ring crew, and Caveman Broda and Brian Jewell and I were on the ring truck. And Broda used to he would go into grocery stores and take the labels off cans and then go to the front and say, I want a discount on this because I don't know what it is. And they would give him a discount. So he had a whole duffel bag full of silver tin cans, and he didn't know what was in any of them. So he'd be like, you want something to eat? Sure. What? I don't know. Ah, it's pork and beans, or hey, it's corn.
And I wouldn't be surprised if he's not doing that in 2019.
Right. He also was the first guy who ever dropped a knee on me from the top rope. And I remember just being terrified. Like, he went to the top rope and he jumped off, and the knee started small and got big until it was like the size of Godzilla's foot to me. And then, of course, didn't even touch me. And I was just like, oh, my gosh. He's great.
The most fascinating part of that story to me is there was ever a time Caveman Brody was on the top rope.
So let's talk about, you know, Winnipeg's got a fine wrestling tradition, as you mentioned, you know, and we all grew up as fans and, you know, the different generations. And you mentioned how you basically put on this tour to give the guys some work and yourself, I'm sure. How do you go about booking a 30-show tour in 30 days?
At this point, we started about 4 or 5 months out. Luckily, you know, doing it a few years now, we've got the pieces in place across the country. But when we first started, we were doing about 5 or 6. And then once we got those 5 or 6 down, we started adding an extra couple markets along the way and take a risk on them once we knew we were kind of solid on the home base front. And from there, essentially, like the way it works in order for us to be successful is we've got guys on the ground in 30 plus towns. It's actually really amazing if you really break down the amount of people and the amount of work and effort that go into making this happen. But it's really kind of an old school model in the sense that we've got local promoters or local wrestlers directly in each of these local markets that are going out and securing sponsorship, getting the tickets to the outlets, putting up the posters, securing the media. And I'm kind of at the helm, just kind of giving direction on where things need to be and when they need to get done. And just trying to find reliable, trustworthy people that have a passion for wrestling that want to see come to their town and do well and come back on a regular basis. Because there's not a lot of major league wrestling coming up to a lot of these parts of Canada. You know, WWE is not stopping by Weyburn, Saskatchewan, or Souris, Manitoba anytime. So they're getting really excited for the opportunity to get some big stars coming to their town and for it to be on a regular basis. So more times than not, we find a good local ground team to get things done for us. And it's kind of trial by error to see if the town's going to work. And if it does, it sticks on the schedule. If not, we give it the boot and try to find something else and just keep on growing it.
And I'm just looking at your list here, and it's Portage the Prairie, Oak Lake, Yorkton, Creighton, Saskatchewan. So you're hitting a lot of the farm towns, Prince Albert, Eston, Red Deer. Edmonton's a bigger town, obviously. You threw up the Squamish, Kamloops, then Calgary. Like you said, Weyburn, Saskatchewan, Regina, Souris, Morden, Thunder Bay, Elliott Lake, Kirkland Lake. I mean, geez, man, you're putting in a lot of miles here. How do you guys travel each day?
We were cramming the car like a bunch of wrestlers cramming a clown car, so to speak. You know, you've got the ring truck, you've got a couple extra vehicles on the road. We cram in and go, and it's, you know, very, very much like traditional territory wrestling. Keeping costs down, trying to keep as, you know, much money in the bank as possible to keep on moving forward. And a big part of why you see so many of those small farm towns, so to speak, on the schedule is because, as you know, like the Canadian geography is so spread out. You know, if you go to the American side of things, you go to any major city in the U.S., you can hit 10 major cities within a 3-hour radius.
Right.
You can't quite do that here. Like just being in Winnipeg, Regina's 6 hours away, and they only have 150,000 people. So you kind of need to connect the dots along the way just for it to be economical in order to be able to travel and wrestle every day and make the most of your gas mileage to make it financially viable to do. So that's kind of how it all kind of puts together.
Do you have a ring truck that goes with you as well?
Yeah, we've got a ring truck that hauls a big trailer behind it, and it's going town to town with us.
So to me, the interesting thing about this is there's always, whenever you're traveling, and, you know, especially I remember back in those days, there's a car will break down, you know, a wrestler will go missing because he had too much to drink the night before, whatever it may be. Do you ever have any, like when you're going day to day to day, if that ring truck breaks down or if the car breaks down, I mean, have you ever had anything like that happen?
Oh man, yeah, that happened. Not this tour that just passed a couple of weeks ago, but the tour that happened in the spring, we had 3 ring trucks go down, some of them being in the middle of the mountains and in the middle of nowhere. So some shows were at risk of being canceled. Luckily, we were able to get, you know, a rental or someone to go pick up the trailer on short notice, which would, you know, have the show start late but still happen. Other times, it wasn't going to make it there at all, and we had to get stretched by a local promoter, stiffing us on a ring rental just to make sure that show kept on going that night. We didn't have to refund people and reschedule a date. So it most definitely happens. It's a reality of what we deal with, especially with the Canadian travel, the Canadian roads not being up to snuff, especially in the northern parts of the provinces. It's a reoccurring thing. And like you mentioned, wrestlers may be partying a little too much and having a little too much to drink is very common as well. So that goes with the equation too.
How do you sort everybody out? Like if you're saying if everyone's traveling together, Like, are you able to the lemmings that wrestlers are? Do you just have a lobby call and everybody has to be there on time and you leave, sort of a thing?
Yeah, that's something AJ could probably touch on, because he's kind of one of my lead foremen, so to speak, in terms of how the crew is coordinated, especially with how big it's gotten and how much responsibility I have to take on day to day with just media and sponsors and the venue and such. But that's pretty much it. You're given kind of you're designated the vehicle you're traveling in, and whoever's running that lead on that vehicle, he's going to tell you a time to be there. And if you're there, great. If not, you better find another way to get to Squamish, BC.
Tell us more about that, AJ. How do you kind of lead the charge there?
Yeah, so I just wanted to touch more on the vehicles breaking down. There was one time where we had to go from Red Deer back to some small towns in Saskatchewan to pick up a vehicle to try and get to Grand Prairie, Alberta on 2 tours ago. And it literally was a 16-hour overnight drive after a show in Red Deer just to try and make it to the next day in Grand Prairie. Like, it was, it was ridiculous.
Right.
But yeah, touching on the call time, essentially, Danny sets a call time, and at this rate, you know, we're all adults and we just hope that everybody's going to make it to the next town, essentially. I think it used to be a bit more strict, maybe a couple of years ago when we were touring, as far as call times and being there at a certain time. Unfortunately, some adults aren't able to make those call times all the time, or taking their time doing certain things. But if the ring crew and the guys get in the ring truck and they get there and they set up, and sometimes guys are late, and that causes frustrations, of course. But at the end of the day, everything seems somehow, I don't know how, things seem to make themselves work out. And the shows, I don't think we've canceled the show yet on any of these tours, despite several breakdowns.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Is everybody staying in hotels?
You're getting a little bit of everything, and that's what I mean by it. It's like we're keeping costs down. Sometimes, like, we got a nice hotel sponsored in town or that we're staying at, and there's other times we're in major markets where some of the boys are at, where we're shacking up with the boys. Or now, you know, you have Airbnb, which is highly popular and a good viable option on the road. So it's really a grab bag of things every single night we're going. So whatever's the most cost effective to keep us, like I said, as much money in the bank as possible and keep moving forward. So there's times there's four of us crammed in a really, really crappy hotel room in Meepawa, Manitoba, just to make a couple extra bucks to go towards food the next day, and you just keep on moving forward. Because it's either the money goes to the hotel to get an extra room so everyone's comfortable, or it goes in your wallet so you can eat the next day.
It's old school wrestling touring there for sure, right?
That's right.
Are you responsible for paying for the hotels for the guys?
Yeah, 100%. And wow. First and foremost, like, we try to go in and get a sponsor to cover it. And luckily, we're very blessed to have a lot of sponsors across the country that kind of take care of those accommodations for us. But there's not always that case when we're going into a town, or especially a new market we haven't established ourselves in yet. So yeah, we're covering that out of pocket. So once again, that's when you're cramming the guys in and trying to keep the expenses down.
So when you're going, I mean, I understand if you mentioned, you know, Souris and Neepawa, there's usually probably a community center that you go in. But when you're doing Winnipeg or Calgary or Edmonton, those bigger cities, where are you performing at? Where are you putting the shows on?
A lot of times what we're doing it at just different local event centers. There's a lot of different popular event centers now in Winnipeg and places like Calgary, but it's very much indie wrestling at its core. We're doing school gymnasiums, we're doing legions, we're doing community centers and everything in between. Pretty much anywhere we can set up a ring, and we've even accommodated the ring to have a set of low posts for places with low ceilings if it's necessary. So we're really covering all our bases to make sure if there's a hall in town and it's affordable to do, we can get a wrestling ring in there.
What kind of crowds are you getting? Like, tell me your biggest crowd and tell me like your smallest.
Man, it's really a grab bag. Like, especially when we're trying out some new markets, there'll be times you'll have 30 people in an audience, and then you get to some of our bigger markets like Winnipeg, Thunder Bay, and you're getting anywhere from 500 to 700 people. So it's really going to vary week to week. And for the most part, it's pretty consistent where you're hitting at, you know, anywhere from 250 to 500. And then from there, you're having the ones that just completely shit the bed and you're wrestling in front of, you know, there's more guys in the locker room than there is in the crowd. And you just kind of scratch that one off the list and you keep on moving forward.
The smallest crowd I had was seven people in Rimby, Alberta. So you might want to stay away from Rimby. That's one of those ones where, like you said, like you can, like, working in front of a big crowd is way easier than working in front of a small one.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause when you get those, you get those sparse crowds of 12, 15 people, they're not impressed that they're one of 12 people that were stupid enough to show up.
That's
that
right.
Night.
Yeah.
And they're not overly excited to be trying to make noise and make up for the people that didn't either. So it definitely is a challenge, but the ones that do invest in it, it ends up being a fun night. So all involved, minus the envelope at the end of the night.
Yeah. When you can see each individual person in the crowd, that's when you know it's bad. Like, oh, there's the guy in the, there's a guy in a red shirt, and there's a lady, and there's a kid, and that's about it. So when you're paying the guys, Danny, is it a weekly check that you do? Is it nightly? Are you offering guarantees for the tour, or is it kind of a percentage thing? How do you budget that?
So that's paid nightly off the gate. So that's kind of been how we've been able to keep on growing as a company and keep on adding more markets. Is, you know, now doing this for 11 years, I've got a very, very good crew that's understanding of the vision and understanding of the model we're trying to build. So we're able to kind of take chances and do those, you know, 38 tour towns instead of a 15 tour town, or sorry, schedule, where guys are being paid based on how the show does that night. So if we go in and we build up the town and we're doing good business, it's reflective of everyone's envelope at the end of the night. But at the same time, if we go into a town and it doesn't do very well, I'm not at risk by not having a guarantee out, by losing thousands of dollars in the company, possibly kind of being put under,
right,
or in a really bad position for the weeks to come. So luckily, usually more times than not, if not every time, balances out in the end, where guys are coming out really well ahead and doing great for themselves, and they keep on coming back. But there's definitely some nights where you're probably looking at your envelope and, oh, what am I doing up here in Canada at minus 50 in the middle of December?
And how do you judge that? Like, do you tell the guys we'll give you a percentage, or we'll give you 1% of the gate? Are you that specific about it? Or is it just kind of like you just kind of divvy it up at the end of the night and which way you feel the guys that were kind of the bigger names on the show or that sort of thing?
Yeah. Like we usually have a tour headliner. Like, we'll have somebody come in who's, you know, got some former WWE or WCW TV experience that comes in as the draw for us. You know, that person's working off a guarantee to be on the tour, but everybody else is kind of working together as a team to build it. So it's divvied up pretty evenly, you know, with there being a bump here and there for guys that are doing some extra work on the road. But it very much is an honor system. There isn't an official system set in place, but the guys aren't stupid. They can look into the audience and see if the show did well or if it didn't, and kind of based on the sponsors and how things are kind of put together in the town, if the show made money or not. So there really hasn't been much trouble or any discrepancy in that case where people are like, hey, you're kind of shorting me tonight, because the house is good. The envelope's usually very, very good as well.
AJ, how is it for you doing like 30 shows in 30 days, even as a performer, with all the bumps that you're taking and that sort of thing?
So, you know what that means? It can be obviously taxing on the body. I've been working now about 17 years. So I've learned that, you know, maybe when we draw that 20 in small town Souris, that I'm not taking a bump every night, or keeping them to a minimal. Still working hard, obviously, but sure. I mean, you're essentially on the road there. I mean, you know how it is. Mm-hmm. You're making a living and trying to, you know, make a go at this. But as I've gotten older, I've gotten smarter about, you know, picking my spots essentially, and making sure that I'm not, you know, getting dropped on my head every night. I'm also a pretty big guy, so if I don't want to fall, I will definitely not be falling.
No, but that's the thing too. I remember doing that. I mean, with Lance and with Dr. Luther, and you know, you're almost having comedy matches, which are just as entertaining as high spot matches anyways. And like you said, when you got 20 people in there and there's 15 kids that just want to, you know, yell at the bad guys, it's really not as hard as people make it out to be to have a good show by not taking any bumps.
Yeah, most definitely. And you can notice when the guys are in front of a crowd like that and they're having fun. And I think the people that are in attendance kind of realize, like, hey, they're having fun, why don't we have fun? And it translates. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of that. So
yeah, and a big part of what DJ said, like, when we, and that's, we're really blessed. We have a lot of top professionals that come in that, you know, you mentioned like Jimmy Jacobs, who's been wrestling for 20 years. We got a lot of guys from Ring of Honor that come up that are so excited. They don't have to work the Ring of Honor style and to work a traditional yay boo Canadian wrestling style on some of these small towns that they don't get the opportunity to down south. But it really makes such a difference when you're dealing with professionals opposed to guys that are maybe just starting out or don't have that polish, because there have been tours where you're working with guys that are very green, just looking for an opportunity, and they're coming up and they are kicking the shit out of you every night.
Mm-hmm.
And that adds up after 10, 15, 20 days. But like this previous tour we did, after 30 days, I legitimately could have went another 30 and not broke a sweat because I was in the ring every single night with guys who are so light, so professional, their psychology is bang on, that they don't need to physically run you down or beat you up to death to get over or get you over. So it really, really, really helps having a professional top-of-the-line crew kind of taking care of you night to night as well. That's a real big part of keeping the body healthy.
Yeah, and you said something. When I did Germany back in 93, and it was 6 weeks, six shows a week. So you got, I think we got Mondays off, and it was in the same city, Hamburg, every night. And I'll tell you what, at the end of that 6 weeks, or you know, three or four weeks in, I was really good because, like you said, you're thinking every night, you're working physically every night, but mentally, psychology, putting together matches. It was different there too because you're in the same building every night, so you had to change stuff up because you had the same fans coming to see it because it was a tournament. But the frequency of that was really sharpened my skills, and I felt really, really good after that 6 weeks was done.
Yeah, and you notice, like, especially like when you work independence, and I know it's probably been a very long time since you've done one, but like in today's world of independent wrestling, so many guys are only wrestling a few times a month, and it's a major difference getting in the ring with somebody who's only going, you know, four or five times a month, opposed to guys that are on the road doing it that many times a week, every month of the year. It's a drastic difference in ability, and sometimes it's just not getting those reps in that's preventing guys from developing. And when you're in the ring with guys that good every single day, like, I can understand why, you know, the wrestlers of the, you know, the 80s and the 90s were so talented, because when you're wrestling that often against talented guys, and if you don't pick it up and learn how to do it, like, there's probably something off with you and you should probably find another profession, because it's fairly simple once you get in there with the right mind leading you through it and getting where you need to go.
Obviously the guys have merch. Do they sit at the merch table? Do you do meet and greets before? I remember Candelo used to do the Polaroids after the show. Are you doing anything like that?
Yeah, that's honestly the bread and butter on these tours, and then how most of us come out, you know, doing really well financially opposed to what you're getting paid each night. It's definitely the merchandising that's still very prominent today, right from the meet and greet. You know, you're charging an extra, you know, premium on the ticket for talent to come in and meet the entire crew ahead of time. So the office is getting a bit of a kickback towards costs. And then the boys have an opportunity to sell directly to the audience. And then most of them are going to stick out there for the general admission as well, and then be back out at the intermission to shill. So, you know, everyone's packing their shirts and their fixtures, and that's where that money's being made.
How about for you, AJ? Are you doing some good merch on the shows? Because I know a lot of times when you go to these towns, you know, fans know WWE or AEW. They know what they see on TV. Are they excited that the wrestling is in town? Are they buying merch? How is that going for you?
So I generally work as a heel.
Gotcha.
So my merch sales are probably not nearly as good as, say, Danny's are, but who works in the babyface. But I find it's the turnaround. So when we go and do a 30-plus show tour and then come back the next time or a couple months later on the next tour, I find after people have gotten the opportunity to kind of see me work, you know, a relationship's kind of built. And I find coming into the town probably the second or third time is when my merch sales kind of tend to go up. Again, as a heel, I'm not selling as much merch as a top babyface like Danny there, but it definitely goes a long way in making sure that these tours are financially profitable.
Well, yeah, that's I can see that for sure. Because when you're like you said, if you're going on getting paid off the gate, and if you do have 200 people there, you know the merch that you sell could be almost as much as your payoff is, if not more.
Canadian wrestling fans are very loyal and very supportive, and it doesn't matter which part of the country we're in. That's kind of how the brand has continued to build. Is once we get people in the door, we've got a very high rate of keeping them there, and they kind of become part of the family. Like, they're part of the push, part of the grassroots movement with us to keep on growing, and they're bringing more people and helping us secure sponsors in the town. And I think they have an understanding that goes a long way for the guys being successful on the road as well. And they're very, very giving in that sense, where a lot of people are very supportive, knowing that goes towards the bottom line of these guys doing it, and do it more so for that reason, just as much as they do, you know, having the merchandise as a collectible.
Do you go back to the same towns every tour? Like you said, you drop the bad ones, but is the majority kind of a little bit of a circuit that you're putting together?
Yeah. So like that tour you mentioned that we just finished, that's pretty much the circuit we're running right now, you know, and then we, towns that don't do well, we'll kind of cut them out of the following tour and then try something else around a town that we know is going to be really successful. So we kind of piggyback if it doesn't do well. But for the most part, that's the way it's been. We were prominently running Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta for about 3 years. And in the last year and a half, we've expanded further into Eastern Ontario. And we just did our first events this year in Toronto and Ottawa. and announced our debut in Montreal coming up in the new year. And then we just started going out west as well, going up to Prince George, BC, Williams Lake, BC, and just did our first shows this year as well in like the Vancouver area. So we're trying to cover and go coast to coast, because that's one thing Canada's never really provided as a wrestling organization, has been its own national touring company. We've always kind of piggybacked WWE or WCW or whatever the hot American brand is. We're kind of getting it by association. So we've never really had our own representation of a national touring company, and we're trying to fill that void and try to make some history in the process.
I think it's a great idea, man. Like I said, just the fact that we're talking on the show now, it's such a unique idea and an original idea. And I didn't realize that you did it regularly. I'm sure there's guys coming out of the woodwork trying to get booked on these tours now.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, it's like, as a wrestler, I always try to be, you know, respectful in the fact that I like to try to get a response from every promoter that I reach out to, which is never the case. So I try to be as respectful as possible and get back to as many guys as I can. But it gets pretty overwhelming now that we're running as many dates as we do, because there's nobody, WWE isn't running as many dates back to back anymore. You know, maybe throughout the year, yes, but not, you know, in two or three individual tours throughout the year. So we're really getting hit up by all ends. You know, the tour this year, we had, I think, talent representing 7 or 8 different countries all on the same tour here in Canada. So people are coming from all over the world. I think as much as Canadian wrestling has been kind of put on the back burner in some people's mind, it's still very much respected as a great wrestling country. So we get reached out to by a lot of people from international countries that want the opportunity to wrestle in Canada because of the great wrestling tradition and heritage here. So a lot of guys reach out with that hope in mind. They can participate in Canada and wrestle just like the Harts and yourself and Benoit, et cetera. So we kind of have our pick of the litter right now. It's a really good spot to be in.
So how do you put together the roster then?
Well, realistically, in this day and age, it's pretty locked with guys that come in and they've been a part of the movement since we've gone from doing, you know, 10, 20, 25 show tours to the level we're at now. If they've been a part of the team and helped it grow to this level where it's now being financially beneficial for guys, I try to take care of them first and foremost and make sure they're invited back. And if their schedule is available to do so, they always have an opportunity to come on back and do it. And if for whatever reason, whether it be availability or injury, that kind of takes them out of the game, then we start, you know, opening up the books and seeing who's been reaching out and who could be a benefit. And whether that be, you know, somebody with some great veteran experience from another part of the world that can add some different flavor to the tour, or someone from another country that could possibly come in and be a benefit to the crew, both as a wrestler or to network to get guys out. That's kind of where we're going first and foremost. Or we just see somebody young with a lot of potential that we know is going to be a big star. We'd like to try to get our hands on them and get a fingerprint on them before they go on to do some other stuff as well.
When you mentioned, I know that you had Juventud on this tour. Do you try to put together a top-level match, or does Juve work with your best guy? I mean, how do you get the main event for the show?
So generally speaking, like when someone like Juventud or any of the other headliners that come in, it's going to really vary on the market. If we're going into some of the smaller markets, some of the small Saskatchewan or Manitoba markets, that's usually where we're going to give our younger guys on the card an opportunity to work with them, because it's going to be a smaller crowd, less pressure, and it's not going to be make or break for the brand if it doesn't go well and then needs to be tweaked better for next time. So that's usually the challenge of doing that. But when we're going into Winnipeg or Thunder Bay or Calgary, Edmonton, where we know we're going to have our bigger houses and there's more eyes on us with more regular wrestling fans, that's when we're kind of going guns a-blazing and putting our best talent in there and putting our best main event forward to make sure that we keep those people invested in the product and make sure we're you know, being competitive with the other local groups that are running in the area.
Who have you used as headliners before besides Juve?
Oh, wow. Man, that's dozens. You know, we've gone the gamut from doing, you know, legends. We, you know, one of our most successful tours was, you know, Jake the Snake Roberts, who is a, you know, a great draw for us up here in Canada and a great mentor in the locker room to the guys. Ron Simmons. We've had Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, Psychosis, the New Age Outlaws, Billy Gunn and the Road Dog. Pretty much anyone from any era of the 80s or 90s has probably been up here at some point. So I think we're going on close to, you know, 80 plus WWE names that have been up this way and on tour or on multiple events at some point. So we try to kind of run the gamut. Canada's very back stuck in time a little bit in the sense that wrestlers from the 80s or the Attitude Era are still very, very big stars here. So we try to lean on them more times than not to come in and draw, you know, not only, you know, the fans, but, you know, they add a lot of credibility in terms of drawing media attention for us. If we're going through, you know, Western or Central Canada with the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase or Jake the Snake Roberts or Demolition or someone of that nature, more times than not, we're ending up on every local radio station, most TV stations, in the newspaper. So we try to lean on those guys for a lot of that, just to kind of create some brand awareness, and then hope that, you know, people come out and check out the show, enjoy the local talent, and keep on coming back, regardless of who the headliner is.
So all those guys you mentioned have been on the 30-day tours?
Not Jake Roberts and Mr. Wonderful have been on 20-plus day tours.
Wow. Yeah. But Mr. Wonderful's not wrestling, though.
Actually, oddly enough, he wrestled his first match since 1993 or whatever it was in Brandon, Manitoba, 2 years ago. We were able to talk him into it near the end of the tour to jump in and do a six-man with us. And I went up to Paul, pretty sure it was going to be a no to get out of here. And said, hey, we have this idea, and, you know, we're going to set up and do a six-man tag for the main event. And he just looked at me and said, well, you better have an extra pair of knee pads. Well, and it was incredible. Even at 60-plus years old, when he got that tag, he came in, and it was 1985 at the Garden all over again.
But for the rest of the tour, is he just doing, like a meet-and-greet sort of thing?
Yeah, generally speaking, when we have the legends that are no longer active in the ring, they're kind of being brought in as, like, a special guest enforcer, or they're being a mentor to, you know, a babyface with grooming and trying to move up the card and being in their corner. And then more times than not, the heel, like AJ, who's probably been on the receiving end of many Mr. Wonderful or Ron Simmons punches to the face, will get in the face of them and dispute how the finish went down and usually end up getting rocked for it.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Has there been anybody that you had a bad experience with that came in?
There was a pretty high-profile case a couple of years ago, or I guess a little over a year ago. We had Brutus the Barber Beefcake on a tour with us.
Yeah.
And it did not go well whatsoever, you know, just from the minute he landed till the minute he decided to take off in the middle of the night after being prepaid on some shows and going home and leaving us stranded. That was probably the only time it's been really a situation that didn't go well for us in terms of, you know, experiences.
Yeah, I read about that, as a matter of fact, the Brutus Beefcake story and the whole scenario. And it's something that, you know, as a promoter, you have to deal with, sadly. I remember, actually, we did a tour once with Candelo where Marty Jannetty was supposed to be on the tour, and he didn't show up. So Candelo would go in front of the audience every day and say, Marty Jannetty is not here. He was busted for drugs at the border, and they wouldn't let him in the country. That was his announcement to the crowd every night before the show.
Oddly enough, Marty Jannetty was my first no-show, too, in 2009 when I started running events.
From 1990 to 2009, no-showing Winnipeg.
Rocking and rolling, starting and stolen, brother.
Yeah. With the Beefcake situation, he left before the end of the tour. How do you deal with that?
Well, luckily, you know, for the few markets that were left, we had built a strong rapport in a couple of them, so they were very understanding. You know, we announced to the audience he wasn't going to be there, that he opted to go home, and we were just truthful about the situation. And, you know, being a wrestler in the industry and being a promoter, I try to keep my name out of any kind of controversy that's going to prevent me from having opportunities or prevent, you know, people from maybe wanting to come up here if they misunderstand the situation. So it was a very, very sticky one in the sense that, you know, money was stolen from us. He left, you know, in the middle of the night when there was advertised dates, didn't tell anybody, and left us in a really bad jam. So I felt, you know, the best route was just to be honest with people about what happened. Here's the situation. And I would say 99% of people were understanding and said, great. You know, we more than understand that. He wasn't why we were coming. It was just an extra, you know, bonus or garnish that he was going to be there. We're still supportive of what we're doing, and we'll keep on coming out. You know, unfortunately, we did have some new markets on that tour that he didn't show up for, and it did cost us some business, and you know, affected our relationship with some media and some sponsors and things of that nature. So it was one of those, you know, shitty situations where we just kind of had to eat it and keep on moving forward and try to build their trust again. But overall, you know, luckily with us touring as long as we have in a lot of these markets, people were very supportive. You know, they'd come to work with me or know me over the years as a wrestler or performer, or sorry, promoter. And we had a lot of support across Canada with people going, hey, you know, we completely get it. You know, whether it was, you know, at the meet and greets or whether it be at the show itself, you know, we had a terrible experience with him too. So we completely understand. And it really brought, you know, kind of forward an entire wave of people that were sharing similar experiences at our events that they had with him that weren't pleasant, that I was unaware of. And I felt really terrible about as a promoter that was taking their money to give them this opportunity. So luckily we had a lot of support. People were very understanding. We were able to kind of grow from it and keep on moving forward.
I hate that shit, man. Like, you know, first of all, why leave with only 4 days left, right? Like, if you're going to leave 2 weeks out. Like, 4 days left, stick it out, whatever the problem is or whatever issue he's having. It's like, why leave so close to the end? That doesn't make any sense, you know?
No, and you know, in all fairness, like, it was the middle of winter. I understand it's cold up here. He lives in Florida. He's not the most mobile guy at his age. But at the same time, like, to his credit, he was drawing us some really good business in some of these markets. And I know he was making us some good money, and he was making himself some good money, you know, with the arrangement we had. And I just didn't understand how somebody who simply had to show up and put his, you know, name on a piece of paper and collect a good sum of cash on a nightly basis when he's not working all that much now, could be so angry and bitter every day. Mm-hmm. It was an eye-opening experience to just how some people, you know, see their life on a day-to-day basis and what makes them happy and what makes them, you know, upset. Because, you know, to just be able to show up and get that kind of recognition at that point in your career and make that kind of money, you think you'd be a little grateful or happy for the opportunities that were being allotted to you for, you know, both the promoter and the fans that are paying to see you. And that was just not the case on either end.
And it's such an 80s thing to do, too. Like, that sort of thing, no shows, that's such a rare thing now. But it seems like guys from that era do it quite often. You don't see guys from my generation no showing, really, unless they're, you know, that's the other side of the coin, real assholes. But that's very, it's a very rare thing.
No, and the worst part about it was I feel guilty in the sense that I've heard horror stories from a few promoters I worked for in the past about him. But I've also heard them about guys like Jake Roberts, who was one of the easiest people I've ever worked with, who did great business and went above and beyond. So when we booked Ruiz, I said, hey, you know, maybe once he gets up here and he sees it's a bunch of good brothers on the road, you know, just pushing through day to day trying to do this, he'll fit in and everything will be fine. And that's usually the case with just about anybody that comes up here. And it just wasn't. And it was just really unfortunate to see that he couldn't make the most of his opportunities, especially he had his book come out around that same time that he was pushing. And we're getting him on all kinds of national and regional media to promote it and doing such. I just didn't understand what more could have been done to make his time more pleasant.
AJ, how is that for you and for the rest of the locker room when you see a guy like that, who I'm sure everybody respects, acting that way? Is it demoralizing, or do you guys take it as a lesson learned?
So I have a little bit of a different take on the whole situation. I got to ride with Brutus pretty much every day of that tour. And I had zero problems with the guy. He was great. He took care of a bunch of the boys. He was buying meals. He was buying beers at the end of the night. I don't think I got to see a whole lot of the stuff that Danny's speaking about, which may have taken place over the phone or whatnot. But for the most part, other than, you know, I mean, like, he was complaining a little bit about the cold and stuff like that. He was great. I had no personal issues. I saw none of these issues taking place. And like I said, he was taking care of us in the ring trucks. So it's different for me in that aspect. So I had no issues whatsoever with him. He was great.
How about for the rest of the big name guys? Good experiences with all of them?
There's not really, I mean, like Danny covered, Jake was amazing. Getting to ride and just pick his brain for guys at our level was amazing. I got to ride again with Ron Simmons, and I can't say enough good about that man. Even at one point, leaving a small town, Saskatchewan, myself, Ron, and another man by the name of Alex Anthony, a worker out of the New Jersey area, we're on the tour, and even got pulled over by the cops. So we were on the side of the road in small town Saskatchewan at one point, waiting for another officer to come investigate something on the car, and just standing there and getting to see how Ron was completely calm, cool, and collected about the whole situation, and just a great man. I can't speak enough good. So as far as headliners go, I personally, just having been on the ground and you know, with the setup crew and generally riding with the guys, I've had zero issues. They've all been great and very, very giving in, you know, as far as like,
that's cool,
critiquing things and offering advice.
On a side note, that Ron Simmons story, one of the most amazing memories I have of that tour, it was actually after the event in Assiniboia, Saskatchewan. And we were behind them on the highway. And I didn't realize it as such. But here we are, you know, blasting through to Regina to get to the next show. And I look to my right, and there's Ron Simmons, AJ Sanchez, and Alex Anthony lined up standing next to a police car on the side of a Canadian highway. And that's a visual I will take with me for the rest of the time.
Only in wrestling, right?
Right.
How was Hoovy?
Hoovy was great, man. And like that was one of those situations where a lot of people warned me about what I was getting into, much like Brutus. You know, maybe even more so, just based on some, I guess, of his past behaviors or people's past experiences with him. And I knew I was really kind of taking a chance, you know, based on what I was told. But after having, you know, Psychosis up here in the spring, who did great business for us, and having a good response to Conan, who we had earlier this year as well, we wanted to keep the Lucha train rolling. And, you know, to his credit, he was nothing but professional every single day. And for, you know, everything I heard, I did not see any of those issues come out of him. So for a guy that was up here for 30 plus days in the cold from Mexico,
right,
completely fine, worked really hard every day. And, you know, it seemed like almost daily I would show up to the events and Hoovy would be in the ring, maybe training with the younger wrestlers and teaching them and showing them stuff. So he kind of took on a role as a mentor and leader on the road and really embraced it and was nothing but professional the entire way through.
That's cool to hear, man. Yeah, I always love working with Hoovy, man. He was so good, you know, and probably still is, you know.
Yeah,
he's going hard. Yeah, most definitely.
On TV, you know, 20 years ago, he's jacked up and in great shape, was in the gym every day, and he looks like he's ready for another TV run.
Yeah, you got to tell me the quick story here. I was scrolling through kind of the Beefcake Experience, but you got to tell the story when you guys did CTV Regina. Do you recall that? What he said?
With Beefcake?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, 100% I remember that. That was just one of those days I just shook my head going, you know, this has got to come to an end. And luckily it did. So it was probably the worst travel day on that tour in regards to just kind of, you know, having to rough it up. Because we were in Medicine Hat the night before, which was like a 4.5-5 hour drive overnight to Regina. And Regina is one of those markets that was a real tough go for us to get going. Luckily, it's one of our stronger markets now, but it took a while to get there. But we were very lucky to be afforded a lot of morning TV time on CTV and Global TV, which are major news stations up here in Canada, especially in Regina. And they allotted us some morning time with Brutus. But we had to drive overnight from Medicine Hat to Regina in order to make the appearance. So it wasn't going to be a pleasant drive. It was going to be a long night, early morning. And he agreed to do it. And once we got there, you know, it was as if he never agreed to it. And he was tied up and hauled there against his will. Because he was rude with just about everybody. I shouldn't say just about everybody, with everybody, you know, from the new staff to the crew, who more times than not are booking the wrestlers to come on the show because they're fans themselves and they just want to meet them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a, you know, a means to an end. They give us the coverage. They get to meet the hero they grew up watching. And it was just miserable with just about everyone complaining from the coffee to the water. Nothing was up to his standard. And then we get on the air. And people start asking, and you can go find this online somewhere, I'm sure. We get on air and, you know, people are asking him about, you know, wrestling now. And what would you say to a, you know, a young man trying to get into the business? And he flat out says, don't. The business is dead. Find another avenue. Wrestling isn't the way to go. It's a dead industry. And here I am on camera with him going, actually, no, wrestling's great. It's building a lot of momentum. It's never been hotter. We got a show tonight in Regina. We're going across the country. And he just completely tried to sabotage us on morning TV. And I had to kind of take the reins and try to cover it up. And it just blew my mind that he would go to that extent to make the drive there and then try to blow everybody up in the process.
Oh my gosh, that's great. It's dead. Oh, by the way, we have a show tonight, but don't bother coming.
Yeah, like... We got to Winnipeg a couple days later, and we had another one, and I could tell he was very irritated with me, because that one's online as well. You can see almost every time they asked him a question that I felt could be swayed in a direction I didn't want it to, I just jumped in and answered it for him, because I was very concerned about that happening again, and I think he realized that and kind of toned down a little bit. But that's kind of what we were dealing with, and it was just a stress, tense, you know, a stress-filled, tension-filled day on a daily basis.
Who is there? Some guys, and you said something earlier that's so apropos, is like Canada is still, you mentioned being in a time machine, still loves the 80s Hogan era wrestlers, like just go nuts for them like no other country in the world.
100%. Like, and as somebody who still follows current wrestling and is a current wrestler myself, you know, I try to spread it out and bring guys in from this era as well. But from a business end, it's never as rewarding as bringing in guys from that era. And I just don't know if they've lasted so many generations or if they were just that prominent in that area that, that parents want to come and they want to bring their kids to meet them as well. But, you know, they're still rock stars up here. Like people, for like Jake, I'll go back to Jake because he did so well for us. Like people were lined up night after night. Like it was, I remember Thunder Bay, the show we had with Jake out there, it was like minus 50 that night and people were lined up like over a block down the street waiting for over an hour to get into to meet Jake. And it was just absolutely insane to see people going that length for professional wrestling in general, but for a specific person in 2019 at a wrestling show.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Let's talk a bit about you, AJ. Danny had told me you had a pretty bad crash. Was that during one of these tours?
It was not. No, it was coming home. My family runs a DJ business here locally. So I was heading home from work and got into a pretty serious head-on car collision in 2015.
And so was it one of those like career enders at first sort of thing?
It put me on the shelf for about 14 months. I had shattered my hip, fractured my pelvis, broke a wrist, broke a hand, a nose. Wear and tear, yeah, a bunch of fun stuff. And then even while in the hospital, had a blood clot just prior to surgery, a blood clot almost go into my lung or my heart or whatever it was. So it put me on the shelf for, I was in the hospital for about 6 weeks, recovery and all that, put me on the shelf for about 14 months. And doctors explained that because of the hip surgery, I've got steel and pins in my hip and my wrist and my hand. And they had said that you probably should not do anything physical because I've got no cartilage left in my hip. So It's essentially bone on bone. So I wasn't sure how things were going to go at the time and was just kind of taking it day by day. And then through rehab and all that fun stuff, I had started feeling quite good and getting in the gym and feeling good doing all that stuff and running and whatnot. So I decided to test the waters after about 14 months and did some shows out in Alberta. And ever since then, I've probably been the busiest I ever have been with these tours taking off and wrestling at least 100 times a year, give or take, for the last couple of years.
That's great. So it didn't affect you overall? You still feeling good in the ring?
No, I'm still feeling all right. Other than getting a little lazy and gaining a couple pounds, I'm still able to do all the stuff that I, was always able to do. Essentially, I'm a pretty big guy. I'm about 360 pounds. I'm still able to do backflips and all that fun stuff. So it hasn't really affected me in the ring just yet. I'm sure a couple of years down the road, though, we'll be saying something a little different. But so far, so good. So I can't complain. Very blessed.
So as we start to wind down here, I mean, like I said, great concept, and I really appreciate and respect the fact that you do this. I wish you were around, 25 years ago when I was on the local scene, because I would have been signing up for every single one of these things. On a bigger basis, for both of you guys, have you had WWE tryouts? Have you worked in the States? What's your overall aspirations? Do you want to continue to forge your own identity with CWE, or are you looking to try and get booked in other places?
A little bit of both for myself. I've been wrestling now, it'll be 17 years coming up, next month. And I've been very blessed. I've been doing work with WWE. I actually did a segment with you on television a couple of years back with you, Kevin Owens, and Seth Rollins as a security guard doing pole part stuff.
Really?
It was like 4 or 3 years ago in Minneapolis. We did a pole part and got knocked over by you guys.
Was I nice to you?
Yeah, you were great. Yeah, very nice. And it was actually, I have actually told the story how good of an experience it was, in the sense of just as minimal and unimportant as our role was as an extra and as a security guard, just learning the psychology of where our bodies need to be for the cameras to catch your facials and things of that nature was a really good, rewarding experience just to take away and bring back home and put in your pocket for another day. But I've been very, very lucky. 2010, I'm used pretty regularly in the Midwest loop when they do extra work there. I've done a dark match, prior to SmackDown as well. I've done a PC tryout. I've been lucky enough to go to Japan a few times and do some work with Ring of Honor.
Oh,
as a performer, I still stay like very motivated and driven that I want to continue pushing forward and be successful as a professional wrestler first and foremost. But at the same time, with this thing taking off and gaining as much traction as it is, it's got my attention as well. And it's kind of, you know, they always say to have a backup plan. I know they probably don't mean have a wrestling back or a non-wrestling backup plan, but just being able to promote these tours and provide for myself and my family, if I can continue to do that in the meantime while pursuing, you know, things as a professional wrestler as well and open up doors, I'm definitely happy doing that as well.
How about you, AJ?
Yeah, so I've had the opportunity. I've worked, you know, all throughout Canada, down in the U.S., and then in 2012, I got the opportunity to go down and train in Mexico with AAA. And as far as like present day, you know, wrestling's kind of paying the bills right now. So just trying to stay as busy as possible. But if something bigger opportunity or something more ever popped up, you know, I would not be opposed to trying that, as obviously the window for something like that is starting to close as time goes on. So I'm just looking to, you know, keep busy. And like I said, wrestling's paying the bills. So the busier, the better.
Have you guys worked for Tony Candelo before?
Yeah, unfortunately. Sure.
What's that, Danny? What'd you say?
I said, unfortunately, yes. Yeah, I did the death tour with Omega, I want to say 2004. I'd only been wrestling about a year, and they needed a referee last minute. So I went and refereed that tour. That was my first, you know, real experience with Tony and seeing the work incarnate that he's become a legend for. And from there, I've probably done individual, you know, shows for him and spot shows, you know, on and off up until about maybe 2012, 13, you know, here and there. But it's been a while since. He still does pop up and show his face once in a while, but he's not running as actively as he once was.
How was the death tour for you?
Well, he's gone on record saying it was the worst one in death tour history.
Oh, no.
I think Omega would probably say the same thing. We're on our way to our first show. And it, you know, it was downhill from there for the 2 or 3 weeks we were on the road, whatever it was, as we were in two different cargo vans. And while driving up to do the first reserve, the van went through a creek, like went through the ice in a creek and got stuck. And we're in the middle of nowhere, I think like 5 or 6 hours away from the last time we saw civilization. And this van got stuck in the creek. There was no getting it out. So one of the vans had to drive back and try to go get help or go get another vehicle. Well, you know, myself, Omega, I believe Darren Dalton and a few others had to just sit in this van, sitting in ice on top of this creek, just hoping it didn't go any further or that they would come back or we wouldn't get, you know, mauled by bears. And I had to sit in there for about, I think, you know, 10 or 12 hours or whatever it was until they finally were able to turn around and come back and get us. But they weren't able to get another vehicle. So for the remaining 2 or 3 weeks of that tour, we had to travel on top of the ring inside a cargo van.
Oh my
gosh. For 3 weeks, we're laying on top of steel and filthy mats and, you know, jerry cans. And you're not driving very fast on those roads as it is, but they are bumpy. So for 3 weeks, we're just driving up and down, just bumping our backs and our heads off the steel ring beams for the entire tour. So it's pretty miserable in that sense. And there's a few other actions that went along the way, but that was kind of, you know, the norm or what you expected going into the death tour with all the folklore of it that you heard prior going into it.
I was lucky. The only death tour that I ever did was during the summer. And there's actually, the promoter was Bob Holiday, Doc Holiday. Ooh. And once again, I mentioned being on the ring truck with Broda and Brian Jewell. I also had to travel on top of the ring as it was stacked. And Brian Jewell did drive very fast, and there was quite a few times with one of the bumps where I face planted the roof of the van a few times. And then the best of all was Brian Jewell, he's driving on, it was the dirt roads, as you know, going up to those reserves. If you're not traveling over the ice in the winter, you're traveling on super long dirt roads in the summer. And he goes, take the wheel. I'm like, what? He goes, take the wheel. Like, I'm sitting in the back, and he gets up while we're driving about 70 kilometers an hour and makes me take over. He basically stands up, holds one hand on the wheel. As I hold one hand on the wheel, we do a quick switcheroo. And if that wasn't bad enough, about 20 minutes later, I look and he's on top of the, and look in the rear view, and he's on top of the ring jacking off. And I was just the ring crew guy wanting to get in the business. And I'm like, am I sure this is the business I want to get into?
Was it just the two of you in the vehicle?
The two of us and Caveman Broda.
And how did Broda sell that?
He was probably just sleeping or had seen it so many times, he didn't sell it at all.
That's absolutely incredible. And that's doing the death tour, like, because it's been, you know, you've talked about it, and, you know, Edge and Christian have talked about it and things of that nature, it's become like a badge of honor for wrestlers to go and do this thing. And if I ever, like, get the opportunity to talk to guys when they're thinking about it, I'm like, you really don't need to, you know, unless you're really green and you just need the work.
Yeah.
And you keep your reps in, like, stay far away from it, because there's not a lot of benefit from it. It's not, you know, financially all that viable. And then the conditions are awful, like you mentioned, minus, you know, that luckily I didn't have to deal with the masturbation on top of the ring, but traveling on it was rough enough. And then you get to the towns, you know, you're sleeping on a gym mat, you know, in the school gym. You'll go 3-4 days without a shower. And, you know, for the tour we did, because we were traveling on the ring in these gas cans, we just reeked like gasoline for weeks on end, unable to bathe. You're not eating right. So, you know, unless you really want to, you know, mark out and say, hey, I did this and I got through it, great. But, you know, as a professional, you probably don't need to if you've got a busy schedule and you're picking up enough work elsewhere, because you're going to probably come back about 30 pounds lighter and maybe lose some hair in the process.
I'd much rather do your tour.
Yeah.
Last couple of questions for you. When you're talking about the tours, what's your game plan for the next few years?
As of right now, our game plan is to continue to try to expand further east, because we now hit the limit, you know, going to Vancouver if we go any further in the ocean. So we're going to just keep on our focus on growing and trying to get out to the Maritimes, where we're hopeful, you know, we've got a good local promoter on deck for our Quebec debut. And if that goes well, that's going to be a nice base for us to keep on moving forward east. And if, you know, that continues to go as planned, then we'll hopefully be popping up in the Maritimes and Newfoundland and things of that nature in the next couple of years. But in the meantime, on the home front where we're at, it's just to continue to try to grow. And that's kind of, you know, the struggle with independent wrestling is, you know, when you're dealing with independent wrestling, you're dealing with an independent wrestling budget. So in order to get the word out there to the masses, can be very costly and not always cost effective. So we just got to keep on hitting the ground and just keep on having good shows and hope that great talent keeps on coming up that represents the brand well, and just hope that groundswell takes off a little bit faster than it is now, and we can hopefully see, you know, some benefit, you know, going on with this wrestling boom right now in other parts of the world.
And you do two of these tours a year or three?
We did two this year. We'll probably be doing three next year.
That's great, man. Great. Final question for you. AJ, what's your favorite match that you ever had?
Oh, boy. Whoa, there's so many. One of the matches that stick out for me was on one of the tours in we did a show in somewhere in Ontario, one of the northern towns. I don't recall, but it was me and my brother, who was also working at the time. We got to have a match with Road Dogg and Billy Gunn. And we drew probably 150, 200 in this particular town. And Billy and Road Dogg were arguing all day about how Billy always gets to do the comeback and Road Dogg always has to take the heat and whatnot. So Road Dogg's like, hey, how about tonight I get the comeback? So after arguing, Road Dogg finally got what he wanted. He got to hit the comeback for the match that night. And he came to us earlier in the day and said, hey, I'm going to hit Billy's comeback. As I'm doing this, I'm going to be doing everything Billy does. We'll end on his finish. And I said, yeah, no problem. So minutes later, after we had left the room, Billy comes in. He's like, all right, what did that a-hole tell you? And we're like, well, this is what he wants to do. He's like, all right, here's what we're going to do. When he hits the Famouser, kick out at one, and then we'll finish the match, however. So Road Dogg's running the comeback on myself and my brother. And as he's doing it, he's looking at Billy, literally flipping him off and laughing at him the whole time. So we're having tons of fun as all this is going on. Road Dogg hits a Famouser, looks at Billy, flips him off, pins me, and then I kick out at two, and Road Dogg just bursts out laughing on all fours, can't control his laughter, goes out, like, slaps Billy and tags him. Billy comes in, hits his finish, 1-2-3. And even in the process, as Billy is laughing over top of my brother, Road Dogg drops an elbow on Billy and runs out, which ends up having Billy hit my brother in the face and bloodies his nose and all that fun stuff. But that match always sticks out to me, and it might be online, I don't recall, but that match sticks out to me just because they were so giving and so so great to us, and getting to work with them as much as we got to was an absolute blessing. And we got to learn a lot. And then just having that story to go with,
sure.
There's so much more, but that's one that sticks out for me. Yeah.
How about you, Danny?
Man, if I had to pick off the top of my head, some of my favorite matches, maybe for me as a fan, would probably be getting the opportunity to wrestle matches against guys like Jake and Hacksaw Jim Duggan and things of that nature. I definitely had matches that were a million times better than all of those that were more, you know, business driven and helped draw the house for us with, you know, whether it be in an angle. But for me as a, you know, as an individual, my favorite matches would probably be working with guys like that. These are the easiest matches in the world. And as somebody who grew up as a wrestling fan, you know, my entire life, this is, you know, the only thing I wanted to do. You know, as much as you become like numb to it being in the business for so long, it becomes just like the ordinary everyday thing to do. I still find it pretty cool, you know, when you're, you know, across the ring from a guy like Jake Roberts and 10 minutes later, you're taking a DDT and the crowd goes crazy. And it's like those kind of cool moments kind of validate kind of why you got into wrestling and kind of inspired and shaped your whole career path. So I probably think one of those matches specifically is some of my favorite.
That's great, man. Well, like I said, much respect to you guys for doing these tours, and I'm very excited that you are. It's great for the boys. It's great for the fans, and you're getting some good buzz on it too. So congratulations on creating something new and something different, which is what you have to do to make it in this business. So I think it's a great idea, and all respect from me for sure.
Well, if you ever want to do one, we'll make sure there's a spot in the ring truck for you.
I'll quit after four shows. All right, boys, stay safe on the road, and thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
Thank you.